RunAsRadio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 126 with guest Steve Riley, recorded Friday, August 28th, 2009. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Hey, Richard. How are you?
I'm good, and you're listening to Run As Radio, and we have a special guest, one that basically needs no announcement, and more importantly, my bio for him I know is out of date, because it leads off with the senior strategist and worldwide security evangelist at Microsoft's Trustworthy Computing Group, and you're not that guy anymore, Steve, are you?
Nope. Back in May, when Microsoft had its second round of layoffs, the Trustworthy Computing Group was one of the many groups that was affected by the downsizing, and several of us were let go, including many of the evangelists. So I'm no longer at Microsoft, and after taking a little bit of time to evaluate what my next move would be and trying to determine where I think the industry might be going, I felt that it was probably time to embrace the cloud, and I took a role as a senior evangelist and strategist for cloud computing at Amazon Web Services.
Very cool.
Neat. Yeah.
Congratulations on that. That's pretty terrific.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's exciting. Very glad to be here. I was around in the days of the ASPs, the application service providers. That's when I kind of got my start at Microsoft in the late 90s in the telco consulting practice. And I never did think that that industry was really going to go anywhere, probably because it was just a little bit too ahead of its time. Encouraging IT organizations to try to outsource their applications, mostly is where they was headed at the time. I was involved in a number of projects, and some of them were successful, some of them were still around, some of them had failed, just largely because the IT shops, I don't think, were quite ready for it then. But the second round of this idea, and it's got a new term, right? Cloud computing is essentially kind of the same thing, although instead of just focusing only on applications, there are various iterations of it, platform availability, or Amazon Web Services more focuses on infrastructure as a service because there's more choices, and we've essentially kind of learned from the lessons of the ASP days and have had a wider variety of offerings that I really think is here to stay. And I'm kind of excited to be a part of that.
Well, and for me, Amazon really was the cloud. They started this whole thing off because it was infrastructure they were using themselves that they had excess capacity on. They said, well, why don't we try selling some of this?
And it turned out to work very, very well. Some of the first customers that really jumped onto this were kind of small shops or specialty computing. You know, think, for example, like a biotechnology firm that needs an enormous amount of compute time for a short period to do some protein folding exercises,
right,
or something like that. If you try to invest in something like that yourself as an IT shop for an organization like this, you're looking at massive amounts of money required, time required to set it up, and the biotech industry is moving so fast that what Amazon Web Services offers was really appealing and remains really appealing to that kind of customer segment where you can essentially just enter a credit card number and spin up as many instances as you want, throw your compute needs across a large number of commodity boxes, essentially, but really it's virtual images. And in a month, have your protein folding exercise finished, shut them down, and you're not paying for them anymore. So the whole idea of pay as you go, only when you need it, is very appealing.
Pay for a service, too, instead of a big capital outlay.
That's right. You turn the expense from a capital expenditure into an operations expenditure, which, I'm not really I don't know a lot about how that's done, but apparently that's, there's a lot more advantages when it's budgeted that way.
Yes, there are.
So, I mean, Steve, you've been a security guy as long as I've known you. Does security play a big role in what you're doing now over at Amazon?
Part of it, yes. I'm not a security evangelist anymore, although that one of the things that I'm focusing on is enterprise customers. While small firms, startups, developers, particular business units of large organizations have been able to jump onto something like AWS very easily and very rapidly, more general purpose IT, as I'm sure many of you have, maybe who are listening today have read or heard elsewhere, there's a bit of a reluctance to move wholeheartedly into the cloud or
right.
line, more traditional line of business applications. And many of the reasons cited for this reluctance have to do with security, compliance, control, where is my data, what happens to it, who takes care of it, how does it get backed up, these kinds of things. So I think one of the things that I'm going to be focusing on, or I'm positive that one of the things I would be focusing on in my conversations with customers is how Amazon is positioning itself to address those needs of traditional IT so that more than just small business units and startups can take advantage of the cost efficiencies and the rapid scale and elasticity that you get with something like this. So take that experience I have in helping organizations understand risk and mitigate those and move that experience into the cloud. So it'd be a great combination of what I've done and what I've known, along with something that's quite new.
And these were the same concerns we had in the ASP era of who's backing up my data, where is my data living, how do I get it back? That whole problem is the same problem.
It is, but we've learned a lot from 10, 12 years ago when we were trying to do that. There's a lot more guidance out there now. There's a lot greater, there's much greater understanding of who owns stuff. I still think we need to get some legislation to kind of catch up with times, but I think you're going to start to see that too now. As you just noticed earlier in the week, there were several news articles of where state and federal government agencies are starting to even look at cloud providers as ways of taking advantage of many of the economies that you get from that. And when you see government starting to look at things like this, I suspect that we're going to get some pretty smart thinking about delineating lines of responsibility between the customers and the service providers. And there will be particular things where each organization is going to have to take care of things. Just simply moving to the cloud does not mean that you abandon your data. You still need to make sure you keep your own backups of it, even though something like Amazon's S3 has multiple copies of your data as well, for redundancy, for speed of access. I still think it's very important that you yourself keep your own copy as well.
What are some of the misconceptions on the part of classic IT pros who are not familiar with the cloud that maybe you could help answer? What are the things that you hear over and over again that you find yourself having to explain?
Well, one of them is loss of control. And I'm kind of happy to say that many of the cloud providers, including Amazon, are really beginning to think very intelligently about how to make sure that people don't lose that control. And I'll kind of brag a little bit about something that we've released here in limited beta earlier this week was Amazon Virtual Private Cloud, where a customer can actually take some of the compute instances, some of the what we call the Elastic Compute Cloud, EC2 instances, and incorporate those inside a VPN. And they are now private. They are distinct from the internet-facing EC2 servers. You access them via a VPN connection from your corporate network to Amazon's cloud. And so it's essentially the idea of extending your IT into Amazon EC2 resources. But you manage them yourself. You can join them to your domain if they're Windows instances. You use your own existing management tools to manage these things. You apply your own policies to them. They are your servers. They just sit in Amazon's data center. So as the technology matures and other providers look for ways to remove the distinction between their cloud and your CorpNet, I think we'll start to address some of these concerns. And people will still be able to control those resources. They'll know where their data is. They'll understand because the providers are being more transparent and open about how the information is protected, but still give IT shops the ability to control that information themselves and use their own security tools. So it's kind of a combination of the industry maturing and effectively communicating the benefits as well as the requirements on both sides.
Now, and in the end, EC2, it's really just VMware virtual machines, right?
They are virtual machines. We have base images that we call Amazon machine images.
Okay.
And there's probably about 30 or so of these. They're public different AMIs, as we call them. You start up an instance of that, and it's like you get a fresh server. And so I've been playing around with a few of these, and of course, probably the one that you would expect would be the Windows Server versions.
Right.
I'm not a Linux guy yet.
I'm still
a Microsoft guy as far as my understanding of technology goes. And then as long as that machine, that instance runs, you will be paying for the instance hours, essentially, and it's some number of cents per hour. I don't remember exactly what the number is off the top of my head at the moment. And when you're done with that, you terminate it. Now, what's kind of interesting is there's a little bit of a difference between when you power down a physical server and when you terminate an instance here. When you power down a physical server, when you own, you can come back tomorrow and turn it back on, and it resumes from its current state.
Right.
When you terminate an instance here, it's gone forever. So we have another service called Elastic Block Storage, where you can take a snapshot of an instance that's running and save that to disk, and then you power down your instance. So maybe you don't need it for a month. Why pay for it? So create a snapshot, save it to disk, power the instance down, and then a month later, when you need it again, boot a new instance from that snapshot. So it's essentially resuming from where you left off.
Right.
But you're right that these are virtual machines. The hardware could be in any of our availability zones. And the beauty is that it will move around, and you can scale, you can add instances or reduce instances depending on the load.
Now, at the same time, you are paying for that storage when you go over to the storage mode, although I presume it's fairly inexpensive.
Yes. EBS volumes are stored in the storage service called S3, Simple Storage Service. And of course, the per gigabyte rate for that is lower than the instance hour of a machine that's running.
Right. So I'm really fascinated with this idea of just extending my data center, because if I've already running virtual machines in my data center and I've got this VPN connection to Amazon, then it seems to me there's no reason I can't just take one of those VMs and stick it out there. Or do I have to create an Amazon instance to do that?
Right now, you base it from an AMI, an Amazon machine instance.
Right.
We are looking at ways of extending that so you can kind of BYOL, bring your own license.
Yeah.
And one very interesting example is that we have a partnership with Citrix where we're looking at, and I was just checking this out yesterday, as a matter of fact, that there's a lab that is online that Citrix is hosting on Amazon EC2, where people can bring their own client instances or their licenses or their own server licenses and run their own images, essentially, that they've already built. I'm just beginning to explore this, haven't looked at it in a lot of detail, but I'm thinking about how this could be extended from the classic kind of server instance that most people think of to client-side virtualization as well, and what maybe you could do if you have virtualized desktop infrastructure served up from Amazon EC2, whether that's through VPC over the VPN connection to your CorpNet, or if what might be even more exciting is having a VDI on the public side of EC2 so that remote workers or contractors who are working from their own, you know, their own facilities instead of in your office building can still get to your customized desktop images.
Right.
I think there's a lot of really interesting things that could happen within that space.
That is interesting. From a security standpoint, you could certainly exercise some control doing that way.
Well,
if you had your virtual call center agents working from home, but you want to, you know, limit access to sensitive information, it seems like that might be one way to do that, as opposed to sending them a laptop and having them do whatever they want with it in addition to the sensitive work that you need them to do.
That kind of depends on really what you expect. One of the things that I was looking at as I was kind of preparing for TechEd US before the layoff happened was a presentation where I was going to talk about different kinds of client-side virtualization. And kind of this interesting thing had bubbled up in many of the conversations I was having in the Executive Briefing Center and CSO councils was the idea of, instead of an organization paying for client hardware, you know, like laptops or desktops or whatever, is it you give a new hire $2,000, go to the computer store, buy whatever you want, bring it in, plug it into the Ethernet, and then you know, you've got your own base operating system. We don't care what it is. It could be, you know, Mac OS, it could be Windows 95, whatever, right? And you run the locked down, domain joined, virtual client, you know, in a VM on
right.
the desktop VM.
So you're still using your horsepower, but you have this image that comes down that runs on your machine and possibly
right.
even goes back at the end of the day.
Yep. Well, what I learned in some of my research was that's not going to do anything to stop somebody's, you know, Typhoid Mary of a laptop from infecting the image and then spreading out to the corporate network.
Right.
Because unlike server-side virtualization, where you have the hypervisor that controls everything and essentially prevents one VM from talking to another, you don't get that on client-side virtualization today. So if you look at virtual PC, or if you look at the desktop optimization pack and the technologies that come with that, there is no VM isolation there.
There's no sandbox.
No, there is not. What we need are desktop hypervisors. And it's kind of funny this has come up, is because I was just reading an article today, as a matter of fact, in this week's issue of Network World about desktop hypervisors. And there's a number of people who are, like NXTOP is one, and Citrix and VMware are starting to look at this technology, and I'm sure that we'll see a version of the Windows hypervisor on the desktop as well. When this comes out, then the dream, you know, the dream environment where the hypervisor actually controls, even on the desktop, isolation from VMs, but still let you get to things like the graphics hardware and the sound, right? That's the big thing you lose
yeah.
if you virtualize clients, is you can't play games, you don't hear noise. This will get to the what I think is the nirvana of what the digital natives are going to expect when they come in. I want to bring my own PC. I want to work. I don't want to be constrained. So, okay, here you go. Here's the corporate image, and the hypervisor actually keeps the corporate image from getting attacked by the dodgy, you know, whatever software you downloaded last night from the internet.
But you can also see that in that environment, the core OS has nothing in it. It is just a host for other VMs.
That's right. And when you look at it, and even when you think about hypervisor-based virtualization, there isn't really even, you know, that idea of a parent OS so much anymore.
Yeah.
The parent OS happens to be, you know, the first one that got booted in this case.
It seems like Win 7 sort of heading that way with its XP emulation and so forth. You start to see some hypervisor-ish behavior.
Right, but I need to be very clear that the virtualization that comes in Windows 7 when you add virtual PC is not a client-side hypervisor.
Right.
As a matter of fact, virtual PC has changed, and it uses terminal server as the presentation layer. So any VM, any virtual machine that you start in Windows 7 with virtual PC has access to the the disk drives of the host, you know, backslash TS client, backslash C, will get you to the C drive of the host, and you can write anything you want to that. So it's not there yet. I hope that it comes soon, because I really love this idea of protected images that can be run anywhere without fear of getting attacked. Not the technology is not there yet, but it's coming.
And also this natural separation of your workload, your gaming load, your productivity load. They're just instead of having a mishmash together, they're isolated instances, possibly all running at once.
And they're even, you know, you can think of multiple instances that are solving business problems. For example, think of a developer working on a project that is based on Linux.
Right.
So he's got his development environment in one VM, and he's got his productivity environment in another VM. And the productivity environment is, say, Windows with Outlook and Office, those applications. And, you know, for years, what have we always said that developers need? They need two PCs, right?
Yeah.
One that's domain joined and controlled, where they do their productivity. The other that, you know, the developer essentially is the administrator and owns and does everything you want. That's really expensive.
Yes.
Most organizations can't afford that. But if we can get to this nirvana of where we have a client-side hypervisor and you have isolated VMs on the client themselves, you know, think, again, you're back to the economies of scale, right? You're doing a lot more and you're spending a lot less on the hardware. So you can focus those resources on actually getting the project done and doing new stuff.
Well, I also love the idea of having those instances centralized in a main server so that they can be patched without having to go down to the desktop hardware each time. Like,
there's
lots of possibilities here once I have it in a VM and can ship it around.
Yeah, and I'm working on a white paper that is essentially targeted at enterprise IT to describe scenarios of what you can do with the virtual private cloud here at Amazon. And one of the scenarios that I'm describing is using VPC to build a test lab. Think about, you know, some of the things you've heard me and many others say over the years at conferences is that you have to test your patches and your software updates before you put them into production.
Yep.
What's required to do that? A copy of your environment, basically, right? You need to have at least one server, probably multiple servers, many servers, where you've got some representation of what your production environment looks like. Put the patches there, exercise them, make sure nothing breaks, then roll it into production. I could probably count on one hand the number of organizations who actually have budget set aside to build such a test lab and maintain it. What really happens is somebody scrounges up a bunch of old PCs, they build a test lab, stuff looks fine, and somehow, eventually, even those old servers end up being morphed into production. So the test labs just disappear. Think what you could do instead, like with VPC. Start with a bunch of Amazon images, customize them, get them to look like your production environment, take snapshots into EBS, store it in S3, power the images down. There's your test lab sitting there waiting, ready for you to go. A new software update comes out. Start up new instances. You've got your test lab running in half an hour. Put the patches on there, exercise them, everything looks good. Roll that into production. Take new snapshots of your test lab, because your test lab now looks like production, right?
Yeah.
Store those, power them down. Now you've got another copy of your production environment. And when it comes time to do more testing, start up new images from those. So you've got this rolling test lab that sits in storage, waiting four times to do the updates, and it always looks like production because you're following this sequence. I think this is one of the many cool things you can do with something like VPC.
That is really cool. It causes me to think of one question that seems to come up every time that we have a conversation or think about cloud computing. And in fact, we had a conversation on a show recently where this type of question came up, and that is, How is a business, if a business wants to run up test labs, what if your application deals with sensitive data? So I come from the banking and financial services world, right, where there's a lot of regulatory control and concern and compliance, you know, type of needs. So if I need to be able to do test environments and or production environments where there's, you know, cardholder type of data or banking account data, What kind of things, what's the story as far as the cloud computing goes? Am I distributed around the world? Can I control, even in Amazon's case, can I control so it's only in certain locations? And what's Amazon's story as far as helping to me to feel confident that that infrastructure is something that I can actually get my brain around and my regulatory hands around?
Right. You can control where in kind of to in a broad sense, you can control where that data lives. We have availability zones in different places in the United States, east and west. We have an availability zone in Europe. And so that can help satisfy some of those requirements, for example, of keeping European data in Europe. We have released some guidance on how to create HIPAA-compliant applications on EC2 and S3. You can download that from aws.amazon.com. There's a white paper there. We have a white paper and a center that talks about security, how we secure the information, and what you can do to develop secure applications on EC2 and S3. There was recently a bit of a kerfluffle in the news about PCI compliance. So we've got some information about, what level of PCI compliance can you attain? But in some instances, again, this is more like looking at ways that the industry is getting a better understanding of what these regulations mean, of how to interpret them, how to develop systems and produce guidance that can help customers understand the best thing to do. So if you were looking at what kinds of regulations you can meet or not meet with the services that we offer, we have that information available online where you can look for more information. But I do have to caution one thing, that if this data is really sensitive and really confidential, there is no substitute for encrypting it. It doesn't matter where it's stored.
Right.
And I, in this case, I don't care whether it's on your laptop or it's on a server that's in your data center or a server that's, a VM in our data center. If it is sensitive information, encrypt it. And then design your applications such that they know how to create, store, and process encrypted data. There's no substitute for that, and it doesn't matter where the data lives in this case.
Sure. That's a good, valid point.
And there, at this point, there's no migration of VMs from our data center into the cloud and back again. I'm just thinking from an audit perspective, it might be useful to bring a VM in from the cloud, run it in my local machine, and let an auditor go over it.
Right. That feature is it's a common request, and it's something that we're looking at doing, but the capability is not there right now.
Because no. You know what happens the moment we're able to do that is Amazon becomes my disaster recovery site. That's my backup data center. I have a copy of every VM up there. And if something, if the meteor hits my data center, I know I can light Amazon up and keep going.
Well, that's actually another one of the scenarios that I cover in the white paper, is that you can use VPC as a way of establishing a disaster recovery and a business continuity plan. It's kind of similar to the patch scenario. And what's interesting about this white paper is that they're all of the scenarios are kind of variations on a theme, right? Is that you keep those regular snapshots of images that, like I said before, you start it from the AMI, but you can customize it to look like your own, and
right.
You can domain join it to your own network, right? And you just keep those updated. And then if disaster strikes in that unfortunate incident where it does, you can simply transition all of the processing over to instances that you bring up inside VPC.
Right.
And you can only access the VPC resources from inside your CorpNet, because it's got to go through the IPsec VPN. But if the disaster is so bad that you even lose your side of the peering point, your router that connects to our network. One of the things that's very cool about booting from the EBS, the Elastic Block Storage, is that you could boot a public instance from the same EBS that you booted a private instance from.
Hmm.
So you could essentially turn your data center on the internet. You power your data center up on the internet if the disaster is so bad that you even lose the customer side of the router.
Right.
That's a very, you know, very interesting scenario. I probably something I would like to really test myself.
Yeah,
see how that works. But the capability is certainly there to do that right now.
This is stuff that I was doing for hurricane protection in the Caribbean, where we were flopping data centers between Cayman and Bermuda because they're so isolated from each other. And it was because you needed to go completely cold, right? We have to shut this entire building down. There's no power. There's no connectivity in and out of it. You lose everything. So you've got to know you're over there and everything's okay. So the idea that I could do that with something that I don't need to keep running all the time, because paying for two data centers, that's bloody expensive. To just have this backup site that I'm only paying storage on, and only when I need it do I switch it on.
When I was writing this section of the white paper yesterday, I was actually reminded of time I worked for an electric company where we began investigating what it would take to have a hot standby data center and to essentially duplicate everything that's in the current production data center,
right?
Including the ES9000, all of the data to... multiple redundant OC3s with the connection in and out. You were looking at multiple millions of dollars to do this. And now, like you said, you can just have that hot standby data center sitting in a bunch of EBS volumes stored on S3, and you pay a few pennies a month to just keep that ready to go. It is really quite amazing.
Yeah, it's an awesome thought. I mean, one of the things that we got into the habit of, we did quarterly swaps between the data centers just so that we were comfortable with it. And the data centers were totally symmetrical, so it made no difference whether you were running in one or the other. I got to think that if I was going to do this with Amazon, I'd want to do that too. Every so often, move everything to running on Amazon and see what it looks like, which of course is going to be very interesting when you get the bill and you look at monthly costs for running off of Amazon, monthly costs for running off my data center. Because I bet they're not the same.
Probably not. and you will actually be able to perform this economic analysis yourself soon. We will be releasing a calculator. It's essentially an Excel spreadsheet that you can download and fill in information about your current costs, how many servers you have, how often, you know, what is their utilization, a lot of variables that you can complete. That will then give you a comparison of continuing to run the environment the way you are versus running an equivalent environment inside EC2 and S3.
Brilliant. So, Steve, what's next for you? I mean, if you just had a big next, what does the rest of the year look like? Where are we going to see you? What trouble are you going to be getting into?
Well, I still consider myself in learning mode. There's an amazing amount of stuff to learn when you... leave a place you've been at for 10 and a half years and try something new.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff going on, in the IT world outside kind of the Microsoft portion that I had been a part of for so long. But I'm getting very comfortable with many of the things I'm seeing right now. I'm very glad for the opportunities that I had to interact with so many different people and executives, and kind of understand the risk side of IT, because I can adopt a lot of that learnings into the conversations that I'll be having with people as I do my work here with Amazon Web Services. I will be joining a couple of my colleagues. We have a few others here who have the same job, evangelism. So that I can become introduced to the events and the customers that typically we talk to. I will be at the Windows Connections event in November. This time, of course, talking about cloud. I have one of the keynotes where I'm going to be very vendor neutral and essentially talking about what cloud computing is and examining the different models that are available. I'll have three breakout sessions then where I will explore Amazon Web Services in detail. We'll talk about management, we'll talk about security, we'll talk about development. Probably won't be making it to any of the other Microsoft branded events this year because I just have a lot of other things I need to do to kind of get myself into the Amazon world. But I do hope to be able to maybe next year start bridging some of these two worlds together.
I can't believe you're staying home. It must be weird for you.
Yeah. My last trip was to Barcelona, and that was in April. And what are we now? August. And I haven't traveled anywhere since then.
That's the longest. It's got to be the longest haul in years.
It's the longest time I've been home. Well, for 10 years. and it's actually been very, very nice to be able to spend more time with my family. I've gotten back on the mountain bike. So, you know, 10 and a half years of international travel twice a month gave me 2 96-page passports that are completely full.
Right.
A lot of great experience, but I guess maybe I'm ready to try something else for a little while.
Good for you, man.
I've been having a lot of fun so far.
Awesome. Hey, Steve, thanks so much for coming back. It's really great to see you land in a great place on a great project.
Hey, thanks, guys. It was good to talk to you again. Great to hear you.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.